Well, good morning. We're going to get started here. I already passed out a few of these. These are the same handouts that we had for last week. If you forgot yours or you weren't here, is there anybody else who needs a copy? I've got a few more here if you would like one. Once, twice. Oh, right there. All right, as I'm handing this out, we are in Genesis chapter number 6 today. And God willing, we'll get through the account of the flood, maybe into the beginning of the Table of Nations in Genesis 10. We'll see about that, but hopefully through the flood narrative. Again, as we're studying through Genesis, remember, we're not trying to answer every single question in the text. We're trying to give you tools to help you understand the book as a whole so that you can read and study it better on your own. Last week, we introduced the flood narrative, looking at the end of one of the sections of Genesis where Noah is introduced briefly, but also we dealt with the thorny issue of the sons of God and the daughters of men, gave you a couple of options to think about how to interpret those things, and as I noted last week, I'll say it again, that's one of those things that Christians have disagreed about for a long, long, long time, so you can take my view or not, that's fine. So, but now we're actually into the flood narrative, and we note here on your handout that Genesis 6:9 starts the toledot in the book of Genesis, which focuses on Noah. Remember that word toledot? It's translated often as this is the book of the genealogy or this is the genealogy of. It's a key marker throughout the book of Genesis. And so Moses, as he writes it, that's indicating a new section of literature. And here we're focusing on Noah and bringing us through Noah and the Table of Nations ultimately to the doorstep of Abraham. So that's kind of the section that we're in here. Moses initially emphasizes in the text Noah's righteous character. His righteous character. Letter B, I think you've got some blanks there. He is called just, perfect, blameless. He is also said to have walked with God in Genesis 6:9. He is shown to be obedient, Genesis 6:22. He's identified as righteous in Genesis 7:1. Noah was a faithful servant of God. And God uses Noah here to bring about the rescue and the deliverance, the salvation of humanity. Moses, as he's writing this, is contrasting Noah with the wicked nature of man and the wicked expressions of mankind. Remember that we've left off here at the beginning of Genesis 6 with the whole earth was full of violence. The whole earth was just in destructive mode. Every thought, the intent of every person's heart was on evil continually. That's the emphasis throughout those first few verses of Genesis 6. And Noah stands in stark contrast to that. Here is a faithful servant of God. In fact, we'll see this in a little bit. We almost get the impression that Noah might be the guy who would fulfill the promise that God gave to Eve, that of her offspring one would defeat Satan, would bruise the head of Satan, that the curse might be removed. We almost get the impression, at least initially, that he might be that guy. And we'll actually flesh that out in a little bit, but we're going to see that he's not. He's not, all right? But he is an example in many ways of honor and faithfulness and obedience to the Lord. And Noah is a good example for us, by the way. There are good things and lessons to take from him. Just in general, we think about, I mean, I don't know, it doesn't tell us how exactly God revealed to Noah that he's supposed to build the ark and, you know, bring all the animals in. I don't care whether it is that God, like, appeared in a vision. I don't care if it's, you know, God speaks to him in a dream. I don't care that if it's a scroll that dropped down from heaven with all the specifications on it. It doesn't matter how you slice it. It's crazy, right? I mean, it's absolutely crazy to think I'm going to build this gigantic boat that sits on dry land, and we're all going to get in it, and we're going to be the deliverers for all of humanity. And that's insane. And in that sense, Noah is a great example of a man of faith. It's a great example of a man of faith. And the text emphasizes that right off the bat. So there's a lot of lessons just personally for us to consider there. But remember also that as we read Genesis, we see that every major figure is not the ultimate hero of the story. So it's not Noah that's the hero of the story. It's God who is the hero of the story. That theme, we've kind of emphasized this, keeps showing up again and again and again in Genesis. It's not going to be Abraham or Isaac or Jacob that's the hero of the story. God and his orchestration of all things and his grace is the hero. God's grace and God, the person of God, is the hero of the story. And I note here in your notes that God's grace, it's evident all over this passage. Yes, Noah is faithful and he's just and obedient, but we also see that God has a plan for the deliverance of Noah and his family. It's not Noah who delivers himself, his family, or ultimately all of humanity. It's God. So God provides the plans for the ark. God promises to give a covenant with Noah and his descendants. And we'll see that covenant in chapter number 9. God provides deliverance for the animal kingdom. Sometimes we might forget that. We think about Noah being rescued, but it's all of God's created order that God is rescuing in this and preserving in this. God provides food for Noah and his family. And God protects Noah by shutting the door of the ark. So it's God who does all of these things. Noah is simply a reflector and a recipient of God's grace in his life. That's what he is. He's a reflector and a recipient of God's grace in his life. And we could read all the way through the flood account. It would take us a while to do so. I'm assuming you know the details of that. And if not, you've got some things to hang on as you read through the account here, just with these notes. But of course, Noah does carefully construct the ark, just as God told him to do. So Noah, he prepares for the flood. We see his righteousness, his obedience, but we also see God's favor and grace towards Noah. Then we move, number 3 there, to the floodwaters. The floodwaters. As you look at the account here, it becomes incredibly clear with the careful chronology of the flood, with its language of complete destruction, that the flood was not a local, but a global phenomenon. It's not a local, but a global phenomenon. And these days you have to say that because the majority of scholarship out there will tell you that this was just kind of an exaggerated account of a serious flood that took place locally. And I think I just read, is it Tennessee that's getting like crazy rains right now and they got standing water all over? I think that's happening in parts of Tennessee around Nashville in that area. They've had like 24 hours of rain straight, you know. And so, we know what floods are, and even flash floods. We see them occasionally in Minnesota. Is it last spring that dam that we were all concerned was going to break? Was it last spring or the spring before? Is it 2 years ago? Whatever it is, I mean, it's relatively recently, right? We know what that's like. We see those kinds of things and those kinds of concerns. I remember as a kid, we went on a trip and we went through St. Louis. I was probably junior high in that age, and we went for the first time in my life to see the Arch in St. Louis. Okay, and if those of you have been there, you know the Arch is right by the river. And typically there's a road that's down by the river that's behind the arch. And this was in that period in the 90s where there was historic flooding all throughout that region. Mississippi overflowing its banks tremendously. And we went down there, and where it should have been a road, and you could go down there and you could access like riverboats for cruises and tours and that kind of stuff, all you could see was the very tops of the stop signs along the road. And it was just one of those times. And we actually went through that time through Nashville, and the old stadium where the Tennessee Titans played, you couldn't get to because it was literally flooded with water, the stadium itself. The grass was covered. Okay, so we know about local floods, and they're very destructive, and they do great damage. There just have been many scholars who have said, and not Bible-believing ones, I'll just say that, that have just insisted that this was just a specific local flood that only affected a small region. It was catastrophic, but God used it as an illustration in Noah's life of his preservation of Noah and his people. But you just read through this account, you can't take the account on face value without seeing this was a worldwide destruction. It's just incredibly clear. And furthermore, it's not set in mythic terms. You know, it doesn't read like a fantasy. There's really specific numbers and dates, events that occur.
Also, the floods, fountains of the deep were opened up, so it was more than just rain coming down, it was stuff coming up from the bottom, too.
Yeah, if you didn't hear that, the fountains of the deep are said to have opened up, so it's more than just rain coming down, it's stuff that's coming up from the ground as well. And you can see some of those chronological markers. After the construction of the ark, a period of 7 days is given to bring all those whom God had decided to save. Rain's going to fall for 40 days, 40 nights. Gives us the age of Noah when this started. 600th year, second month, 17th day, and so on. And the waters cover the earth for 150 days. We've never seen a local flood where that happens, right? That's just not the way things work. And even if you say earth is supposed to be a localized area, again, have you ever seen of a flood that covered everything for 150 days in a vast geographical area? No is the answer, right? That doesn't work. We have the ark stopping on top of a mountain, and it gives us timestamps for that. Tells us how long the waters continue to fall. The waters continue to fall after the flood, and so on. So you see all of these things, and you realize that this is not set as some sort of fantasy myth. This is designed to say these things actually happened.
In 2 Peter 3:6, it says, "By which the world that then existed," talking the entire world, "perished, being flooded with water."
Yeah,
it just says it specifically right there.
Yep, New Testament affirms in 2 Peter 3 what the Old Testament clearly teaches. And we can note also the description of the extent of the flood's destruction. Chapter 7, verses 19 and 20, the waters covered all the high hills. Chapter 7, verses 21 through 23, all flesh died. And you see throughout all of this that even though Noah is faithful, we come back to this theme, that God is the chief actor in sparing Noah and his family. God is the one who's doing all of this. Of course, there's a lot to learn also about God and the severity of his judgment here. He takes sin seriously. He takes his glory seriously. He also takes what he has created seriously. And he intends to preserve and to make it right, which is what we see here. The flood actually becomes theologically a foretaste of the future judgment that is to come, even as Scott mentioned there in 2 Peter 3. All right, now we have Noah's exit from the ark. Very clearly, Noah and his family, the animals come out of the ark at the command of the Lord. Again, you see God's the one in charge here. Noah's first act is to worship God by offering a burnt offering. Interesting to note, the altar of Abel is the first one mentioned, a burnt offering of some sort in the Bible, but this one is the second. And clearly the Lord accepts this sacrifice. God resolves in his heart to never destroy mankind with a flood, but let the seasons continue normally. And we have great great examples of God's faithfulness in that pronouncement of the seasons. Now let's talk a little bit about the covenant that God makes with Noah and all living creatures. And I think here this is worth us reading, because I just want to talk about some things about covenant for a few moments, because it's going to become important as we understand how the rest of Genesis develops when we get to the person of Abraham. So we just have the promise of God's not going to destroy the earth, and then we have this beautiful statement at the end of chapter 8, while earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night shall not cease. And so then we read in chapter 9, verse 1, so God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, hearkening back to what was said in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, and all that move on the earth, and all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things as the green herbs. This is a change in the way that God is instructing humanity to relate to its created order. But you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning from from the hand of every beast. I will require it from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother. I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. As for you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it. So this is all, and just in general, change the way God is instructing humanity to relate to each other, to God, and to the created order. We're allowed now to eat meat here. The fear of animals will fear us ultimately, and also capital punishment is instituted as divinely sanctioned in humanity. Verse 8, then God spoke to Noah and his sons with him, saying, as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you. And notice that language, I establish my covenant with you. This is me to you, all right? And with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. So this covenant is interesting. It's made with Noah, all of his descendants, and even it applies to the animal kingdom. Right? That's just interesting. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Nevertheless, shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And then God gives this sign. This is the sign of the covenant which I make between you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud. I will look on it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. And so God's covenant with Noah here is what we would call a unilateral covenant. It is a unilateral covenant. God had said to Noah back in chapter 6 and verse 18 that he would establish a covenant with Noah. And now he is making good on that promise. Now, just in general, leading up to the covenant, God renews the blessing of children. God expands Noah and his descendants' food choices from just the herbs to also to animals. God protects life since humanity is to be made in God's image. And specifically in this covenant, God promises to never destroy the earth by means of flood. Never to do that. Now that leads to an important question that is going to show up again when we get to Abraham, and that is, what is a covenant? What is a covenant? It's an important biblical idea. Now, the idea of a covenant is not something new or invented when Noah experienced God's covenant with him. Covenants were very well established in the ancient Near East. All ancient Near East covenants, that's what we mean by A-N-E there, all ancient Near East covenants were legal instruments. They were legal instruments which incorporated two essential elements. So they're very important. First of all, the element number one is that of relationship. Relationship. They establish a relational bond between two or more parties. So two or more. Could be just two, could be, you know, several groups there. Second, a covenant contains... Oh, yeah. So what is a covenant? Covenant, and I'll for those of you who don't have blanks there, or don't have sheets, I'll try to review this as well. All ancient Near Eastern covenants, as I mentioned, were legal instruments. They established, first of all, relationship, a bond between two or more parties. And secondly, here's letter B, they establish obligation. Obligation. And what we mean by that is that there are stipulations, there are parameters, there's procedures that define what that relationship looks like. Now, in there is actually quite an extensive literature that has been produced on covenant terminology. In other words, we find this not just in the Hebrew Bible, but we find it all over the ancient Near East. Two of the most prominent versions of this, and you can find them in other languages, is in Hebrew. That's the language of the Old Testament, certainly the language of Genesis, or the vast majority of the Old Testament. Daniel has a little bit of another language. But in Hebrew, we have the word berit, which means to cut a covenant. Cut a covenant. Akkadian, which is an ancient language in the Near East, ties to ancient Babylon. They use the term parusu, which means to cut or enact or establish. They also use the word bertru, which is a bond, pact, or treaty. Now, let me just give you full disclosure here. When it comes to Hebrew, I can muddle my way through a little bit. I know nothing of Akkadian, so I'm relying on other greater scholars than me. Yes?
A, you have, it says Hebrew, and then you have something written in Hebrew, but you don't, what is that?
Berit. Berit. Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I'm trying to remember on how to transliterate that. Yeah, it's B-E-R, I think E-T, but you use like funky symbols at the top to get the right sound out of that. So, I'm sorry, that is a good note for me to change on that. The key is that when you use the word covenant here, it establishes a formal agreement. A formal agreement. Now, there are different kinds of covenants that exist both in the Bible and exist in the ancient Near East. Okay? So there's different kinds of covenant. Some covenants primarily defined vassal loyalty. Now, that's not a vassal is not a term we use very often anymore. So a vassal speaks of a lesser governor or prince or king who serves sort of as a puppet or an extension of a more powerful king. So if you read through the Old Testament, you actually see this in play quite a bit. You know, later in the time of, you've got the split between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Israel. And the longer they go on, the worse and worse in general the kings of those nations become, and also the more oppressed they become by surrounding nations. And you'll actually read at times where it'll say that such and such Assyrian king or Babylonian king or whatever, or Egypt, like they install a king in Israel. Or you'll see that, you know, the king of Israel goes and brings a whole bunch of gold to whatever king to pacify them in order to maintain the stability. In almost every one of those circumstances, you had probably some sort of covenant that would have been cut between those two nations. And the lesser king, as Israel was being oppressed, agreed that we're going to do X, Y, Z and you do this, and we'll be good, okay? And I'm not trying to get political at all, but we're seeing this actually a very similar idea on display right now on the world stage when you're trying to deal with, like, the relationship between Ukraine and Russia, okay? In the United States. That's what I meant to say, Ukraine and the United States, okay? Now, you can have your opinions on all of that, whether that's good or bad, but that's the same idea, essentially. You're going to do this, and we'll guarantee that, okay? And so this is not new. These define vassal loyalty. So these kind of covenants work where a superior party gave obligations to the inferior party to be loyal. And that often worked out on both sides, because the superior party would maintain its strength, the inferior party would be guaranteed certain rights, privileges, and securities. Some covenants, letter B, primarily rewarded vassal loyalty. Whereas the first kind focused on the inferior party to be loyal, the second kind focuses on the superior party to reward the lesser parties. These covenants are known as royal grants or royal gifts. They award favors to loyal followers and often had stipulations for each subsequent generation. Now, you will hear Bible teachers use the words unconditional and unilateral to describe the covenant that God made with Noah and also later Abraham. These are actually very important words. Not all covenants were unconditional or unilateral. I prefer the term unilateral, but the term unconditional also works as well. These royal grant covenants were different than the bilateral covenants. The bilateral covenants would be those of the vassal side of things, where it's like, you agree to do this, I agree to do this. These royal covenants were different than those bilateral, bi meaning two, right? Two parties in coming to an agreement. I do this, you do that. Unilateral covenants focus on the powerful sovereign king and his gifts to the vassal's lesser king. Bilateral covenants focused on both parties and their obligations to each other. Now, what you see with Noah here is that Noah and the covenant that God made with him is of that second kind, the royal grant. God just gives this to Noah. He gives this to Noah's descendants, and he gives it to all of the animal kingdom. So this is God's favor towards his created order. This is an aspect of God's grace. Now, in terms of how a covenant was made, there's actually a great deal of confusion about this today. Covenants could have several elements to them as they were made. They could have a sacrifice that was given with it. They could have a meal provided for the parties of the covenant. They could have a symbol or token given to show the covenant. But here, number four, this is the most important thing. The essential element of a covenant is the oath. It's the oath. The oath ratifies the covenant. The oath is what makes it effective or actuates it. Until you actually have the swearing of the oath or oaths, in the case of a bilateral covenant, it doesn't do anything. So it's not quite the same, but we might think of it this way, all right? So let's suppose that you're in the market to buy a house. Bad time to do it, but you're in the time to buy a house, right? Okay, you're in the market to buy a house. And your realtor, she's, you know, they're working really hard with you to find a house. You finally find the perfect house. You've negotiated all of the terms of the deal, and you're actually going to show up and actually, you know, sign all the documents you need to purchase that house. And the realtor actually meets you at the title company, you know, to sign all the paperwork. It's a pretty common thing to do. Or maybe it's in his or her office. Sometimes you have both parties that are there, the person who's selling, buying, not always. In fact, these days, not usually, but you're going to go sign. And the realtor is celebrating with you. And so he or she brings some housewarming gifts, and you know, it's a celebration that we've got your house. All the paperwork is there, and you all celebrate. You're excited, you know, and you can see the keys that are hanging right there to your new home. But what actually needs to happen for you to take possession of that home? What do you got to do? You got to sign. And these days, it's not just one signature. If you've been through this recently, you know, I've purchased a couple of homes and now refinanced a couple of homes. And every time I've done it, the stack of paperwork just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, and you got to initial now like every page and multiple places on every page, right? So you go through all of that work. And so, yeah, you actually have to sign. You can have all the attending circumstances, but if you don't actually get to that signature, the covenant is not enacted. That is the key to understanding covenants. Now, what you see here is that God enacts the covenant, and this is what we mean by unilateral. Una means one, like unicycle in a one wheel. It's that it's God making this covenant in effect. This is what I will do. Now, God could say in that covenant, this is what I will do, and I'm going to assume that you're going to do this too. But there's no like mutual like coming to terms. This is just a one-way street, right? That's a little bit, in fact, it's a lot different than you see with the Mosaic covenant later with the people of Israel. The Mosaic covenant has a whole bunch of things where God says, okay, here's the deal. I'll do this, and you do all of those things over here, these things over here. And actually, that gets formulated most clearly in the book of Deuteronomy, where you have this grand scene where the people of Israel speak on one side of a hill the words of God and his obligations, and the people of it, half the other people are on the other side of the hill where they agree to the terms of the covenant, and they say, all right, if we do this, God will bless. If we don't do this, God will curse. And they go through all of those things. That's a bilateral covenant. This is a unilateral. It's completely of God. I will do this for you. Now, Genesis 9 contains several of the elements that come often around the covenant. There is a token that is given in terms of the rainbow, right? That's a sign that the covenant is in effect. But the key is of the oath. God swears it. This is what I will do. You know, we sometimes sing the hymn, "The God of Abram Praise." There is in one of the verses, "He by himself hath sworn, I on his oath depend." That's the idea. God himself swears a covenant. We'll see the same thing with Abraham. This is what I will do. So this is completely of God. So we're saying this now because it's going to show up even more importantly in the life of Abraham. Now let's quickly get through the curse of Canaan here and the blessing of Shem. Here we see this at the end of Genesis 9. Of course, if you know the story, the basic outline is Noah's come off the boat. God has made this this incredible covenant with him, with his descendants, with all the creatures on the earth. And now Noah starts planting. He becomes a farmer. He grows a vineyard. He starts producing wine. He gets drunk. And he is in his drunken stupor, is found naked in his tent. His youngest son, Ham, comes in, sees him, doesn't do anything about it, simply goes and tells his other two brothers. The other two brothers act much more nobly. They walk in backwards, and they cover their father to cover his shame. And so that's the basic context. And then Noah, when he wakes up from this, pronounces a curse on Ham's son, Canaan, and a blessing upon Shem. All right, so why in the world is this in here? Just in general, verses 18 and 19 introduce the sons of Noah with particular reference to Noah's grandson, Canaan. That's really important. The mention of Canaan here cannot be overstated. Canaan is a dominant theme in the rest of the Genesis narrative, specifically the land of Canaan, as the name Canaan appears 40 times after Genesis 9. It's very important. The land of Canaan, of course, is where Abraham and his descendants go to sojourn and eventually take possession of the land with the people of Israel. The reference to Canaan was particularly important to the nation of Israel, and even more so when they first received Genesis from Moses. Because remember, the setting of this is they're receiving the law, these first five books, the Pentateuch, the first five books, they're receiving that just before they enter into the land of promise. So this is setting them up to understand why God had given them this land. That's a key here. Now, just a little bit about Noah after the flood. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. There are, I think, some obvious parallels between Noah and Adam. They have the same job, caring for crops. The language of the curse appears with both, and we could take time to look up all of these. Both experience the shame of nakedness. Both of their sins, Adam in partaking of the fruit and Noah's drunkenness, brought about sorrow for their families. And in this sense, Noah is a second Adam. However, unlike the true and better Adam, Jesus Christ, Noah proved, he was not the one to end the curse. In fact, just quickly, look at Genesis 5. Remember I said earlier that Noah, you get the sense that he might be the guy, he might be the one to redeem humanity from its curse and all of the earth. And the narrative, the text actually encourages us, if you just think about it in the flow of this, that to think that way, at least initially. Genesis 5:29, and he called, he's the son of Lamech, Noah, he called his name Noah, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord had cursed." He's going to bring relief. He's going to be the one. Obviously, he turned out to not be the one. So one of the things that Genesis is doing is, you know, it gives us this promise. There's going to be one from the seed of Eve that is going to redeem humanity from the curse that God has placed upon humanity and also the whole of the created order. And so we come up with these people like Noah, like Abraham, like Isaac, like Jacob, and even to a lesser degree like Joseph, that we think maybe this is the guy. But all of them show, even in their faithfulness, they're not faithful enough. They're great, but not great enough. Noah is an example of this. So in this sense, Genesis offers, this is a big word, but I want you to learn it. Genesis offers an eschatological look. E-S-C-H-A-T-O-L-O-G-I-C-A-L. Eschatological. That's a look to the future. So there's this growing sense that we need redemption, but it's not here yet. And in fact, if you get to the end of Genesis, there's a key statement that occurs. We've been mentioning it in 1 and 2 Samuel, where Jacob gives promises and prophecies about his sons, and he mentions that there was going to come a king from the line of Judah. All right, so there's a growing theme. Noah looks like the guy, but the last we see of him is actually sinfulness. He's drunk and in shame, bearing the curse that God had placed upon him in the earth. Now, Noah's drunkenness and its results. Let's just talk about the curse of Canaan very quickly. The incident that brings about the curse is Ham's disrespect of his father in seeing his father's nakedness and doing nothing about it. Of course, this leads to the question is, why then was Canaan cursed? That's the grandson of Noah, son of Ham. And why was not Ham himself cursed? There's a number of suggestions. I'm just going to give you one plausible one that I think is probably the best. But again, interpreters disagree on this one. But I'm just going to give you a plausible suggestion. First of all, Ham was the youngest son of Noah. In fact, Moses emphasizes this in verse 24 of chapter 9. Second, Canaan was also likely the youngest son of Ham, as he is listed last in the genealogy in Genesis 10:6. Therefore, Noah was pronouncing judgment upon Ham's youngest as retribution for his youngest's sins. I think that's a at least plausible interpretation there. Note, though, also that the curse and the blessing given by Noah are pleased to God. Noah did not have the power in and of himself to bring about this curse. Theologically and practically, this was an encouragement to the people of Israel, as they would know that God answered the plea of Noah to curse the people of Canaan, those whom they were going to dispossess of their land. They're just about to do that. And they can see this was said way back then, and God is fulfilling his grace towards Noah in answering this plea. Furthermore, there's the blessing of Shem. Both Shem and Japheth are blessed, but it is Shem that receives the greater blessing, if you read through this. The significance of this blessing is that all the peoples of the earth were to come under the blessing or rule of Shem, and from Shem would come Abraham and the people of Israel. And that really, this transition sets us up to getting us very soon on the doorstep of Abraham and the people of, ultimately, towards the people of Israel. All right, I'm over time, so I need to be done. So thank you so much for your patience, and we'll get ready for our morning worship service.